The first reading this morning comes from a letter written by Albert Einstein in 1941. This letter is often edited by people in such a way as to try to make Einstein say something that would please them better. But this is the whole section of the letter that people sometimes fraudulently edit. And as I've been working on the sermon this week, I have been completely shocked at how much people take the words of Einstein and twist them, make them up, create stories about him that never happened. And if you look him up online, I would only go to one place, and that's the WikiQuote. It's the only place that actually authenticates the quotations on the whole web. The rest of the web is filled with nonsense. People really wanted him on their side, and the fact was he was on his own side. This letter might surprise some people. I'll deal with it in a sermon.
I was barked at by numerous dogs who were earning their food, guarding ignorance and superstition for the benefit of those who profit from it. Then there are the fanatical atheists whose intolerance is of the same kind as the intolerance of the religious fanatics and comes from the same source. They are like slaves who are still feeling the weight of their chains, which they have thrown off after hard struggle. They are creatures who, in their grudge against the traditional opium for the people, cannot bear the music of the spheres. The wonder of nature does not become smaller because one cannot measure it by the standards of human moral and human aims.
And the second reading is a most excellent poem by Lucille Clifton, published 19 years ago.
I am accused of tending to the past as if I made it, as if I sculpted it with my own hands. I did not. This past was waiting for me when I came, a monstrous unnamed baby, and I, with my mother's itch, took it to breast and named it history. She is more human now, learning languages every day, remembering faces, names, and dates. When she is strong enough to travel on her own, beware, she will.
Thank you.
I was backpacking with a friend many years ago in Yosemite National Park. We were ambling on a narrow path alongside the Merced River, which roared like molten silver next to us. It was beautiful. As we moved past huge rock outcroppings, we suddenly chanced on the most amazing sight. Above us, a flat, curving shelf of granite was jutting out about 20 feet from a steep, rocky cliff. The shelf appeared to be about 5 feet thick. Now, it's coming out like this. Here's the cliff. There's the shelf coming out. Growing underneath the shelf was a pine tree. The pine tree had grown upside down out of some little crack in the rock. Tender white roots had found some nutrients there, enough to grow a tree downward until it hit the sweet spot where the morning and afternoon sun made it past the shadow of the shelf. And then it curved, that pine tree, growing toward the sunlight. So the tree grew like this. Here's the shelf. There's the tree. And there it was, above us, larger by far than any Christmas tree I've ever seen. Its U-shaped trunk, at least 5 inches in diameter, rooted in the shadow of a shelf of granite, but green and bright in the daylight. My friend and I were just shivering with wonder at the mysterious sight. How tenacious and stubborn life is, we said. How strong and insistent. For Ken and I, this amazing sight was a wondrous natural occurrence. Like all of life, flora and fauna, in the vast history of evolution, volcanoes erupt, storms destroy, and now and then an asteroid strikes the Earth, wiping out a million species or two. And yet, life defies the horror, rises through the smoke and the clouds, adapting, adjusting, and taking on new forms and new faces. For a few hundred million years, trilobites everywhere. Now, not one. For a few million years, human beings have been becoming themselves, changing, growing taller, stronger, smarter. Will we humans last as long as the trilobites did? I don't know. I know that we are here right now. I know that I am here right now. And I know that my capacity for wonder and amazement at this mystery of life growing, developing, stubbornly evolving through the age is central to my religious life. Absolutely central. In many ways, its fountain and its source. The iconic Albert Einstein constantly asserted throughout his life a similar idea. In fact, it amazes me how much time this scientist spent writing about his religious views. For example, in 1930, he wrote, "I maintain that the cosmic religious feeling is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research." Wow. I hear him suggesting that his inner sense of religious wonder has actually served as his diving board from which he dives into the deep waters of scientific study and theory. He seems, however, to have intuited or suspected that some folks were going to give him a hard time for using the word religious, since some associate that word with rigidity, cruelty, and mindless credulity. Yet he insisted relatively late in life, so he had plenty of time to think about it, "I have found no better expression than religious for confidence in the rational nature of reality as it is accessible to human reason." That was in 1951. And just so he wouldn't be misconstrued for writing that, he penned the following words, very clear words, in a letter to a free-thinking questioner a year later. "The idea of a personal God is quite alien to me and seems even naive. However, I am also not a free thinker in the usual sense of that word, because I find that this is, in the main, an attitude nourished exclusively by an opposition against naive superstition. My feeling is religious insofar as I am imbued with consciousness of the insufficiency of the human mind to understand deeply the harmony of the universe, which we try to formulate as the laws of nature. It is this consciousness and humility that I miss in the freethinker mentality." But Dr. Einstein, as the first reading made clear, got clobbered from both sides. Einstein himself works with the rather strong verb to bark. In fact, "I was barked at by numerous dogs who are earning their food guarding ignorance and superstition for the benefit of those who profit from it." He's referring to the fundamentalists of his era, who berated him for daring to talk about religion in a way that they didn't like. These controlling and reactionary religious people, he boldly accuses, were not only guarding their own ignorance, but were profiting from it. Oh, if he only lived now. But poor Dr. Einstein got it from the other side, too. His fanatical atheist critics, as he put it, in the Soviet Union of Stalin, really got to him. They were so frenzied with the idea that religion is merely the opiate of the masses that they ridiculed Einstein constantly for maintaining, as he did all of his life, that the cosmic religious feeling preceded and supported his scientific endeavors. I do suspect that the undercurrent of anti-Semitism, which oozed through Stalinist Russia, may have intensified this critique of Einstein, but nevertheless, Einstein really did get it from all sides. But he was hardly the first person to describe the cosmic religious feeling. He was hardly the first person to link it to reason and a rational exploration of the harmonies of the universe. The famous Pythagoras of the Pythagorean theorem we may have memorized when we were in high school expressed exactly the same ideas. He considered his reasonable approach to the universe entirely rooted in his own religious feelings. They had several things in common, Einstein and Pythagoras. Like Einstein, Pythagoras was a vegetarian later in his life. Like Einstein, Pythagoras went so far as to suggest that everything in the cosmos was connected mathematically. But Pythagoras went further. He said that everything in the cosmos was connected the way notes and intervals in music, when connected, make a song. Pythagoras' most recent biographer explains the scientist's famous phrase, "the music of the spheres," this way. By saying this, he was saying that the stars and the planets moved according to mathematical equations, which corresponded to musical notes and thus produced a symphony. Einstein, you may remember, uses Pythagoras' exact idea, music of the spheres, in his letter, insisting that his atheist critics suffer because they cannot bear to listen to the music of the spheres. He is saying that they allow themselves no sense of wonder, no feelings, because they refuse to listen to the beautiful harmonies of the cosmos, leaving them as arrogant and as rigid as the most fanatical fundamentalist. Now, Charles Darwin, who was born, by the way, 202 years ago yesterday, didn't use the word religious in the way that Einstein did or in the way Pythagoras did. Oh, he understood that he had been raised in a religion, the Anglican religion, and that his wife was part of the Unitarian Wedgwood family, Unitarianism being a religion. But he himself was not religious in the sense of either denomination, nor was he given to the kind of imaginative, almost mystical feelings which grounded Einstein and Pythagoras. But this doesn't mean that I think Darwin's spiritual ear wasn't attuned. I just don't think he was listening to the music of the spheres. I cannot find any evidence that he was experiencing any cosmic religious feeling as he set sail around the world on his voyages. But I am convinced that he was listening to something. I think from the very time he was a child, he found himself listening not so much to the music of the spheres as to the symphony of humane justice. Here's why I think so. Just as Einstein, a European Jew, offered his theories in an age hostile to Jews and many other minorities, just as Pythagoras offered his ideas in an age of warring Greek city-states founded on slavery, so Darwin offered his understanding of the origin of species in an era when chattel slavery was rife and when others were not embarrassed to profit from the sale of human beings as property. And so Darwin heard movements from the symphony of humane justice all of his life, a spiritual music filled not just with harmony, but with bitter dissonance. The dissonance, for example, of hearing the Unitarian author Harriet Martineau at his dinner table reporting her horrified observations of slavery in the American South after she toured the South. The dissonance of hearing the actual crack of whips and screams from slaves in Brazil as he made his way port to port in that country. The dissonance of hearing world-famous scientists like Louis Agassiz proclaiming that Africans, Asians, and Islanders all had entirely different origins from European people and were inferior in every way. But in most great music that I know, dissonances move toward resolution and harmony. So Darwin also heard achingly beautiful themes as well. I think of Thomas Clarkson, the chief force behind the abolitionist movement in England. You can see him sitting at Darwin's table too, Darwin's lifelong personal hero. I also think of Darwin learning from his dapper, well-spoken Hottentot guide while he was in South Africa, never daring to tell his Hottentot guide that in England and America, he wasn't even considered human by people like Louis Agassiz. I even think of Darwin reading children's books to his own children. Specifically, one comes to mind, Our Cousin in Ohio, written in 1849, a book about the Underground Railroad here. All of these beautiful melodies in the symphony of justice and moving themes are working toward resolution. These themes in the spiritual symphony of justice move throughout his days, strengthening him as he made his scientific observations leading to his famous book, Origin of Species. Just as Christian abolitionists like Wilberforce were inspired by the story of Adam and Eve, the parents of all humankind, no matter their color, so Darwin, in offering his well-documented understanding of the origin of our species, recognize that a common ancestry and equal inherent dignity precluded any possible support from malevolent institutions like slavery. Einstein and Pythagoras heard the music of the spheres. Darwin heard the music of justice. Each of them, moved by either their passionate or thoughtful spiritual experiences, went on to do scientific research, perfect theories, and to change the world. But none of them confused their religious, ethical, or spiritual grounding with the scientific work that they did. Darwin never offered us something for us to believe in, as if the idea of evolution was a tenet of some religion, as its fundamentalist creationists and other critics insist. It is not. Einstein's religious feelings preceded his scientific study. Darwin's ethical commitments live side by side with his scientific scrutiny. My own religious life is grounded in feelings about the universe, wonder and awe, which are supported by observation, that beautiful river and the curving pine in Yosemite, for example, and by my own delving into the majesty of evolution as Darwin and many other scientists have described it. But it's not my religion. The evolution of life in its various species on Earth is not cuddly and warm. I know that. Lucille Clifton calls this history a monstrous unnamed baby. The death of whole species does not make me think of the word cute. The plagues and catastrophes which have wiped out life are scary and violent. But please, the harmonies of nature proclaimed by Einstein and Pythagoras, however, were not soft-focused romantic harmonies, mere elevator muzak instead of a profound symphony of life. Both of these people were grown-ups. They knew the tougher sides of nature, the mauling by wild beasts, the fact of wars, or the explosions of stars in the sky. 40% of the citizens of our nation reject Darwin completely and accept creationist mythology as a fact. Very often these people accuse me of arrogance, insisting that if I accept Darwin, that I have somehow overstepped my bounds, as if Darwin and I were supplanting every possible notion of God. Again, Lucille Clifton's words, I am accused of tending to the past as if I made it, as if I sculpted it with my own hands. I did not. This past was waiting for me when I came. I am simply a new current dancing briefly on the surface of a stream of life that was flowing a billion years before I opened my eyes and will be flowing, I hope, a billion years after me. I am part of nature, not over nature. I don't expect justice from nature or soft-focused romance, but I am awed by it and its procession of life. And that's not overweening arrogance, but an echo of at least a bit of humility. But personally, I do need the warm and cuddly side of things. I do depend on feelings associated with the wondrous beauties of the natural world, as well as loving relationships with others. And I do require visions of humane justice, which evolution simply does not offer me. So I choose to mine the spiritual languages of the various historic religions. I do that with a liberal hand, of course, and turn to the parables of Jesus, the tales of Buddha, Mirabai or Nanak, the poetry of mystical and prophetic poets, and the letters of lovers to give shape to my awe and to my wonder, and to give me the strength to get through the day. I am not like the freethinker that Einstein pushed away, intent on scouring God from the English language as if that word could only be understood superstitiously, or as if there was demonstrably nothing else to religion but lunacy. I have no problem if someone wants their deep understanding of God and the scientific process of evolution to be somehow related. I do have problems with people who not only reject Darwin's origin of species because their rather idolatrous vision of God demands it, but who then accuse the poor man of being the spiritual impetus to everything evil ever done by the Nazi Party in Germany. If you don't already realize this, the internet is jam-packed with this nonsense, and that, folks, is lunacy, for real. Me, I'm not much of a backpacker anymore, never was much of one to begin with, if the facts be told. So I'm much more likely these days to stoke my sense of awe and wonder by turning to the deep green, 3-inch-high shoots of some glorious spring flower. I think it's a crocus, now rising up in the glass courtyard in the back of this building. Nothing so grand as the roaring Merced River or the U-shaped pine growing out of the rock, just a simple song of coming spring that calls me to my deeper life, the deeper life which Einstein dared to call religious. Maybe your most compelling music is a dream of justice like Darwin's. Maybe the symphony you listen to daily is indeed the music of the spheres, like Pythagoras heard within him, or Einstein did. To me, one is not more valid than the other, and we need all kinds of depth to build a humane world. I can think of many other songs, symphonies, or sonatas of spirit that might call you as well, but all of them, and each of them, I'm convinced, evolved within the nature that you and I are part of. And how wonderful is that? Service is going a little long. It's okay.